My name is Steve Farnsworth. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 18th, 1989. And I live in Boynton Beach, Florida. Don't have a home group. And we had one, but we shut it down in January. And then we were trying to start it back up at a new location before the pandemic hit. So we're kind of homeless in AA. I trust that something will reveal itself. So just to give you a little bit of background, I got sober when I was 28 years old. I'll be 60 years old in about a month and a half. And I was stationed in the Navy up in Brunswick, Maine when I got sober. I was flying airplanes for the Navy. They made it very clear to me that I was either going to fly their planes or be a drinking person, but I wasn't going to do both. And I wanted to keep flying their airplanes. I knew that drinking was becoming a problem. I had lots of alcoholism in my family. And I knew that, and the one thing that I knew was that of all the people that, you know, that everybody in the family knew, I had that kind of an issue. The one thing that was in common with all of them is they couldn't see it in themselves, but they could see it in others. And so I had that awareness, I think what allowed me to have open mind enough to consider the possibility that I might be the last one to figure it out if I do have a problem. Add to the fact that I had a lot of little, I don't know, like we used to call them jackpots. I don't know. I haven't heard that in a long time. You know, just a lot of situations where I, you know, some alcohol related incidents that, that nobody knew about except for me. And, you know, when the Navy said, you know, that they wanted me to go to rehab, they, you know, also added on there that said, you know, if you don't, and if you have an alcohol related incident, you might not get to stay in the Navy. And if you do, you might not be able to continue flying. And so I instinctively knew that what that meant was when they find out about the alcohol related incidents that have already been happening, because they just didn't know about them because I was successfully keeping them, you know, on the down low there. So I accepted their invitation to go to rehab. And in June of 89, that's when I went, but in hindsight, you know, how you say it's 2020 and examining my experiences, what I know today is that there's a whole lot of things kind of came together like the perfect storm back in June of 89, where I had good reason, good evidence to not take my thinking seriously anymore. I told the intake counselor or the doctor at rehab some things that I really believed. A little bit into it, I realized that those things were lies, which is not a surprise to me. I was not a stranger to lying, but but the thing that got my attention is I forgot that they were lies. I was really believing my own lies. And so, you know, my thinking's credibility was in question. I had a wife at the time, and it was, you know, she was leaving. The Navy was, you know, really on my back a lot. Finances were just a wreck. You know, repo man was, you know, breathing down my neck. The, you know, house was getting ready to go into foreclosure. And there just wasn't one area of my life that wasn't a problem. But so I had all that going on. And then when I was in high school, I used to do a lot of LSD, and I really liked it. So I got very excessive with it. I get very excessive with things that feel good. And unlike anybody else I know. But anyways, I always knew what it was like to go on a trip, right? But I always knew who I was going to do it with, what it was going to look like, when it should end. And what I realized in rehab was that my drinking patterns, me as a drinking human being, was taking me on a trip that I just didn't sign up for. I didn't know I was on it. And so what I got from that is a healthy respect for liquor. You know, I accepted that there were people on this planet that could drink safely, and I'm just not one of them. Wasn't shocked by it, but I just really accepted it. And so I came home from rehab with a sincere desire to be a sober person. And, you know, I was, you know, listening to a lot of good people, well-meaning people that were telling me that, you know, drinking is my problem. If I can just stop drinking and stay stopped, I'll be okay. And the way to do that is to go to these meetings. And so I'm like, okay, I'll do that. And so I started going to the meetings. I wasn't really impressed with the meetings. But I wasn't tolerating too many people in my life at all, but I could tolerate you guys better than I could tolerate people outside of AA because at least I knew that you guys knew that we were all screwed up and we were trying to get help, where I saw the rest of the world that didn't even acknowledge the fact that they were screwed up. And it was really obvious, you know, like even today, you know, we have, you know, the whole world, you know, trying to tell me that I'm diseased and I got some kind of a sickness. And, you know, I'm 31 years sober and I look at these people and I'm like, okay, well, you know, I know I'm not a picture of mental health, but you're not either. I'm looking at these people that are calling me diseased and I'm like, you know, you're pretty screwed up yourself. The only difference between you and me is I know I am. And I'm trying to do something about it. So I'm not a big fan of the disease concept these days, but it doesn't matter. I don't want to get caught up in semantics or controversial issues, but either way, I instinctively knew that back then. I knew that, you know, that we all had our lot of challenges. And the reason why I hated people in AA less than I hated people outside of AA was because I knew they were trying to do something about it, but I was still hating everything and everybody. And honestly, growing, you know, looking back at it, you know, at that point, I felt like I had good reason. You know, I had to endure a lot of really, you know, crazy things growing up that most people don't have to endure, but they have to endure other things. You know what I mean? So it's, you know, I just got my set of challenges, but either way, it was, you know, it was, I can understand now why I was, you know, so hateful. I didn't express my hate very much. You know, I just had it. It was just something that was inside of me. You know, I would put on a show and try to be kind, but I was not feeling it. And so, you know, I tried to stay sober. I did stay sober actually, or if you want to call, you know, abstinence, you know, sobriety, but sober mind and body and soul, not so much, you know, maybe the body. Yeah. But I was crazy. I had, you know, committee meetings going in my head 24/7 that wouldn't let me get a word in. It was not fun to be Steve Farnsworth, you know? And I couldn't concentrate at work. And so, you know, the Navy was having about enough of me. They had done everything they could to help me. And so I set myself up for an involuntary discharge, but it was an honorable discharge. They had this thing where if you get passed over for promotion twice for the same rank, then they discharge you. But like I said, I knew it was the only way I was going to get an honorable discharge. And so I set myself up for that. And they let me go in the reserves. They gave me a big severance paycheck. So at that point, I'm about a little over a year sober, and you know, got a bunch of money. Had a you know, somewhat of a kind person on the outside, and had a very well exercised body. So I was getting a lot of attention, and I picked up a serious sex addiction. And in the process of me trying to satisfy that, I ended up moving to Maryland, because that's where my mom was, and I like free rent, and so that's what I went there for. And that didn't work, and so I moved to California for about 4 months, and that didn't work. And then I moved back to Maryland, and then I moved back to Maine, And then I moved to Boston, and I kind of ran out of ideas and money at the same time while I was in Boston. As God would see fit, Boston has something like 60 or so universities with a fresh revolution of, you know, meat puppets of hormones every semester. And so it's a really good place to get the job done with my sex addiction. And I kind of tore it up so bad that I ended up with a virus that there was no cure for. And that was at 6 years sober, getting the gifts of step zero and just going to meetings and not drinking. And stayed in that condition for about a year. And then that's when I met my sponsor. And that was in July of 1996. My sponsor's name is Tom Flynn. He passed away in 2013, April. And it's amazing to me that he's been gone over 7 years. But honestly, I don't think a day goes by where I don't hear his, you know, one-liners or his laughing, or, you know, it's like he's like, ever, you know, he just lives on, and his presence is real. But he saw me, and I went up to him and I asked him if he would help me, and he had me meet him at another church a couple nights later, and or AA meeting at a church, and I told him my story. And he said, well, you obviously don't have a drinking problem. You haven't had a drink in 7 years. Looks to me like you have a serious, you don't have a drinking problem. You got a serious case of sobriety or something like that. I forgot what he said. But basically, he was telling me that, you know, my sobriety sucked because I was completely self-consumed. I wasn't doing anything about the real issue. And I didn't know what the real issue was. I didn't know what he was talking about. I never heard anybody in AA talk about what he was talking about. It was just the circles that I was traveling in. And so I just started following him, because it was almost like trying not to look at a car accident when you drive by it. You know, the stuff that he was saying and the stuff that he was doing was just so different. And I had thought that I experienced everything Alcoholics Anonymous had to offer, and I was wrong. And so, I'd get in the car and, you know, he'd fill it up with a bunch of other people and, you know, he'd say something and then I'd say something. And I just thought I was obligated to, you know, chime in because of my 7 years of misery. But he said to me one day, he said, Steve, how about if you just sit there and shut up? We don't want what you have. And I wasn't used to people talking to me like that, right? But I shut up and I looked at him, and he said, and he, with the kindest eyes, he said, you don't even want what you have. And I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot about that, right? So that's what I did. You know, I just started. It was such a beautiful gift that he gave me. You know, it was basically an invitation to make it okay for me to just sit there and listen and watch and be quiet. You know, it was a beautiful gift. And so John, this guy that I take care of is trying to get over here, and I'm trying to tell him to go away. So anyways, I know there's a couple people on here that probably would like to say hi to him, but we'll have to do that another time. So we just started going around, driving around all over the place and trying to figure out, I mean, just trying to, you know, go places to look for people to help, going to different meetings. And we were traveling sometimes for a few hours, you know, like up to Jersey and different parts of Pennsylvania, down to Virginia. It's just amazing that in the road trips were almost like the best part of it. But we would take the actions, and then we would discuss the cause and effect of the actions that we were taking, rather than sitting around studying it, trying to figure out what we should be doing. And then eventually, if we can, you know, motivate ourselves, go do it. It was really the same way I learned how to drink and do other substances. I didn't, you know, go into an in-depth study about, you know, drinking. I just did it, got the results, and then we talked about it. And we learned and grew up and you know, figured out the cause and effect so we could, you know, repeat what we wanted to repeat and not repeat what we didn't want to repeat. And it's the same thing with the way I got sponsored by Tom. And so he immediately got me into trying to help others. You know, I assured him that I was not qualified. He assured me that he knew. And he said, you know, you're not qualified, and I know you're not qualified, but that new guy doesn't know you're not qualified, so get over there and try to help him. And so that's what I would do. I would just walk up to these guys and just put my hand out and offer them friendship. Honestly, the fact that I had 7 years was a benefit, even though I was miserable because, you know, most people in AA think that time means something, you know, which I think is a joke. You know, if I'm 35 years old, I got 35 years worth of experience with these principles. I sure as hell have a good experience of what doesn't work. But, the Big Book is very direct about how drinking is just a symptom. But, you know, the way we behave in Alcoholics Anonymous, it looks like, you know, everybody makes it all about the drink. And I get that. And so these guys that I was meeting, they'd be like, oh, you got 7 years. Okay. Yeah. Will you sponsor me? I'm like, oh my God, are you in trouble? But I would just do it, you know, and I guess the nice thing that I had going for me too, was I was not afraid to say I didn't know when I didn't know. Yeah. But let's go find out together, you know, cause one of the things that Tom taught me right off the bat, you know, like when he told me to go over there and tell that guy, he said, go tell that guy what you do to be sober because and happy about it. He said, but don't tell him what you think, you'll kill him. Like, what do you want me to say to him? He said, God will tell you when you get there. And I'm like, I don't have it with God like that. Why can't you tell me now? He's like, because you'll screw it up between here and there. Just get over there. Right. And so I'd go over and I would just start talking to him. I think his first guy, Gary, I even said to him, I said, Gary, that guy wants me to try to help you. And I don't have a clue how to do that. So I'd appreciate it if you make it look like I'm helping you, you know? And Gary and I became good friends. And what I found is, you know how they say that the eyes are the windows to the soul. And what I found is that, once I actually get past my fears and I just go over there and I introduce myself and I ask him how he's doing and help him get a cup of coffee or whatever and listen to him and look him in the eye, what ends up happening is we just see each other's soul, you know, and we can start sharing that way. And now I don't need to think about what I'm going to say. I just let it happen naturally and just, you know, just try to help. And I learned that right off the bat. And that was another gift. One of the things Tom, you know, taught me too was, you know, about getting people into service quickly. He'd say, Steve, these new guys are like wet cement. You got to get them moving while they're wet. Because if you wait, that stuff will harden up and you're going to have to get a jackhammer to get them to do anything. And so, so it's like, you know, mentally and worldly and intellectually, you think, okay, I got to go through step one and go to the next hurdle. And then finally, if I ever get to 12, then I can go help somebody, but it's really kind of backwards. You know, we kind of go out and help people and then we, you know, and the steps show us how to do it more effectively. And we do it more like, rather than looking at them like hurdles, I look at them more like guardrails, these tools that I just keep practicing. And the more I practice them, the more effective I get at it, the more second nature it becomes in my daily living. And so I really took to it. I really took to this helping others business. My heart came alive. My spirit came alive. My perception of the world around me came alive. You know, it's like I went from black and white to, you know, color. And, you know, all the things that were blocking me off little by little, I kind of compartmentalized them. And next thing I know, this love that I knew when I was a little kid, but I hadn't felt in a very long time, you know, just kind of came through because it was always there. I was just blocked off from it, from my worldly, you know, clamor. And so I just like everything else that felt good, I got excessive and I started getting excessive with trying to help others. And so, I ended up, moving up to York, Pennsylvania for a bit. I'll tell you right now too, within a very short amount of time of me going out and really just trying to be of maximum service on a nightly basis, I had, you know, people in AA, particularly from the circles that I was traveling in before, telling me that I need to slow down. You can't sponsor that many people. You can't sponsor women. You can't sponsor people out of your geographic area. And I'm just kind of looking at them. I'm like, you know, why? And you know, I don't know who you are, but I sure don't want what you have anyway. So I don't know why you're offering me this advice without me asking. These people are having a great experience and, you know, and we're having fun. I still got way too much time on my hands to think about myself. And I'm just going to keep doing it. And if you don't like it, call the AA police, right? And we don't have AA police because if the spiritual consequences aren't painful enough, then we drink. We get the bottle to keep us in line. And so I just kept doing it. And I ended up in York, Pennsylvania for about 4 years. And I had some sober houses there. And I wasn't planning on doing that. That's not why I moved to York. It just kind of evolved. People gave me opportunities and I gave it my best shot. When I was going up there to do it, my sponsor, Tom, he said to me, he said, "Steve, these yahoos have more petty problems than you have money or time." And I'm like, "Nah, I think I can do it." Right. And so I went up there and gave it my best. And I wouldn't say that my best wasn't good enough. You know, I didn't get the results I was really looking for, but there's a lot of really beautiful things that came out of those 4 years, mostly because I had my heart in the right place. I really wanted to help people. And some of them are still sober today and having a lot of fun and really enjoying their lives. They got wives and kids and it's just really beautiful to see, you know, when, you know, I can remember like yesterday when they were, you know, knocking on death's door and completely hopeless. It's really, you know, it's an experience you shouldn't miss, you know, but I got to the point finally where, I didn't want to, I couldn't do it anymore because what happened was, I kind of adopted a physically mentally handicapped old man. His name's John Fuchko. He's actually in the other room right now. He, was supposed to come to my house in New York for the weekend. And that weekend was about 15 years ago and he's still with me. So, I have a running joke that I was praying to God to put somebody special in my life. And I forgot to be specific and be careful what you pray for. But, John is, absolutely one of the brightest spots in my life. And, but he can also be a pain in my butt. But anyways, what happened was, is, you know, the guys were abusing me and I knew it and I knew that I needed to do something different, but all of a sudden they started abusing John and I couldn't take that. And so I pretty much just, you know, packed everything up and I moved back to Maryland and took John with me, of course, and got him into a, well, we had an apartment for a bit, but that didn't work out. And then I got him into a group home and I was, you know, working full time still. I worked at the same company for 20 years, even though I moved around a little bit, I would work remotely or contract and stuff. But anyways, I had this really heavy heart about John's situation. And I had this flying gig, so I was still flying, where I would go down to North Carolina for weekends and I would take guys with me. And I don't know, Dwight, is that Nick sitting next to you up there? Who's that sitting next to you? Is that Nick? I can't see, it's too small. No, it's not? Okay. Well, anyways, Dwight's son, Nick, I was sponsoring. And it was just his turn to spend the weekend with me, you know, on this little cool little trip where we get in the private airplane and we fly to this island and hang out for the weekend. And we were sitting on the beach one night and just talking. And I was just telling him about how heavy my heart was about John and the situation he was in. And he said, well, and I made a joke. I said, I should put him in a box and ship him up to you in Amherst because Nick had some houses up in Amherst. And, you know, when he was doing it, you know, I told him, I said, "Nick, these yahoos have more petty problems than you have money or time." And Nick's like, "No, I can do it." And in all fairness, Nick did a much better job at it than I did. But anyways, I made a joke. I said, "I got to put John in a box and ship him up to you guys, let you guys take care of him." And Nick said something like, "I think that's a wonderful idea, but I think you should come too." And I told him, I said, "I think that you are high, because that is not happening. I just got out of that situation in York. I'm not doing it in Amherst." And by the end of the weekend, I'm like, okay, how am I going to quit my job and tell my sister that I'm moving out? Cause looks like I'm moving to Amherst. And so I ended up moving up to Amherst in Labor Day weekend of 2010. And when what was to be one house very quickly turned into five houses. And, you know, I was helping his dad, who's on this call right now, Dwight, and I was helping him, and I was doing his finances and doing his tree business and is starting a roofing business and five houses and all these little clients. And his girlfriend at the time was there, and I'm trying to help her. And looking back, I'm like, I have no idea how he did it, but all I have is fond memories from it. You know, it was like another thing. It was just like this daily chaos type stuff. But there was so much love. There was so much love amongst everybody. And here again, there's still a bunch of people there that are still doing well, and they're sober, or maybe had a few relapses, but they're sober again, and doing really well. And they got kids and wives and families and careers. And it's just so, so beautiful to watch. And then we brought Tom up there. My sponsor, Tom, came down with Alzheimer's. And so he got to stay there with us for the last couple of years. And, he actually passed away up there. We gave him a beautiful service up in Belchertown, and then we gave him another beautiful one down in Baltimore, and buried him. And I remember being back in Maryland, and, cause I, at that point I decided I was going to move back to Maryland. And so I did, but I remember driving into Baltimore on my way down from Amherst. And I'm on 95, and I'm looking at the skyline of Baltimore City, and all I could think, and this was like April-ish of 2013. And I met my sponsor in July of 96. And so it was that, what is that? Like, six, you know, 17 years. Right. And I was just thinking about it. I'm like, wow, what just happened in those, you know, 17 years from 96 to 2013. And all I could think about was, now that was a trip, right? And then I started thinking about the promise in the big book about the rocket ship ride, you know? And the rocket ship ride hasn't stopped. I had a couple, I don't know, 4 years, I guess-ish, in Baltimore. I was doing some more stuff with an inner city sober house and then I met, I knew this guy from South Florida who Tom also sponsored. I think he had quite a different experience with Tom than I did, but, you know, it was still a really good experience, and Tom really liked him and I really liked him. But he was up in Maryland visiting, and I asked him if he'd come speak at my group at the house that I was managing, and then took him out to dinner just because he was an old friend that happened to be in town. And so I was 20 years at my job, and I was, you know, coming up on 30 years sober. And I'm thinking, you know, if I'm going to start another career, I should probably do it now. And I want to do it where I can use my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous to try to, you know, be more service. And so I was putting in this application package at the University of Baltimore for some kind of substance use coordinator or something like that. And I just simply asked John, if he would give me a character reference letter. And he asked me why, and I explained. And then he said, well, I got a better idea, but it's going to require you to move to South Florida. And I said, John, I just got done telling God that I'm never moving again. And so God's got some control issues, because now I'm on my way, now realizing that I'm moving to Florida. So I moved down here in November of 17, got a pretty cool job, a job that I would do in my retirement, even if I didn't need a paycheck. I do need a paycheck, but even if I didn't, I would do that job. It's kind of a political position for a nonprofit that oversees and assesses and certifies sober homes, you know. And, you know, he said, between your experience in York, Amherst, and Baltimore, what you definitely have is a lot of experience of what doesn't work. And I'm like, you're damn right I do. So that house in Amherst, by the way, is doing really, really well right now. I heard they just got certified by the same credentialing body up there that I work for down here. And that's awesome. But either way, I really enjoy getting up and going to work every day. I really enjoyed the people that I meet with. The challenges that I have in the job are a new experience for me, so it's fun, and I'm having a good time. And I stumbled across a house that's perfect for my lifestyle. You know, John's got his own little area. I'm very content. I'm very happy. But all those things are nice. But let me tell you something. You know, in the 30 years that I've been sober, 31 years, there's been times where I've had a lot of, good money in the bank and a nice car and all this stuff, nice place to live and stuff going well. And there's been times where I wasn't sure if my car was going to make it the next couple of days. And I wasn't sure where I was living. And I didn't really have a whole lot of money. And it's just cycled. But the one thing that stayed consistent throughout the whole time is I had love in my heart. You know, I had a full heart and a strong spirit and a lot of hope in my heart. And so I feel very blessed about that. Now I know that I'm supposed to talk about steps 10 and 11. So I'm going to, attempt to do that. And I want to start off with a disclaimer that I don't speak for AA. You know, I know I can sound a little passionate about the way I see things, but please don't mistake my passion for arrogance or condescending towards the way you see things or any kind of self-righteousness. I really celebrate everybody's journey, but this is just mine that I'm going to share with you. You know, I already told you that I look at these steps like guardrails. I don't like to look at them like hurdles. I don't live day to day. I live like paradigm to paradigm, situation to situation. And I don't get daily reprieves. I can have a great morning and then start doing stupid shit in the afternoon and have an awful afternoon. You know, I get paradigm reprieves and once I go through 3 through 9 and really reconcile my past and clean up any wreckage and learn and grow from the experiences so I don't have to repeat them, what the 10 step does for me is it shows me how to behave, in my present. And then the 11 step shows me how to get hope and guidance and direction for my future, through prayer and meditation. Whether I'm talking about what's the next word that needs to come out of my mouth or where would I like my life to be in 5 or 10 years. Again, that's where I get guidance and direction. And it's also a beautiful avenue, to say thank you and, to be grateful. Cause like I say, a grateful heart will never drink. I don't think I'm necessarily in fear of drinking, but I definitely, need to concern myself with, getting caught up in all the messed up thinking that precedes the drink. You know, in order for me to pick up a drink right now, it would have to be preceded by a lot of messed up thinking. It's the only way it's going to happen. And so when we talk about the drinking, it's really more about the messed up thinking that precedes the drink that I concern myself with today, because there's a point where if I keep going on that, with that, those, that thinking, it's eventually going to lead me to a drink. And the way I protect myself from that is intensive work with others. So in general, what I'm saying is the 11th step is kind of my proactive way to stay in the moment and to stay on point and to not forget my primary purpose and get that guidance and direction that I need. But I'm human and I fall short and I have to fall short. You know, if I didn't know darkness, I wouldn't recognize light, let alone appreciate it. If I didn't know fear every now and then, I wouldn't be able to recognize or appreciate love. And so the idea is to minimize the fear, not eradicate it. And so when I do get popped into that fear, I got the 10th step as more of a reactive tool to bounce me back. And this is I'm going to try to explain to you the way I see these things. So the 10th step, is on page 84 and 85 of the big book. It's right after the 9th step promises. It talks about as far as cleaning up the past should continue for our lifetime. Again, the guardrail analogy. And that it says, while I'm doing that, I need to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is all language of the heart. So the effectiveness is going to come in the heart first. But it says, while I'm doing that, it's to continue to watch for fear, resentment, selfishness, and dishonesty. Now, the little flavor of AA that I like to put out there, it's all fear. You know, resentment, selfishness, and dishonesty. It's all fear. It's all me, under the illusion currently that I'm in a set of circumstances where there's no loving God. And fear creeps in as a loving design to get me to go back to God. Just like if I don't drink water and stay hydrated, thirst kicks in to get me to go back to go get some water. Same thing if I don't eat food, hunger kicks in. If I don't get rest, being tired kicks in. And so these are all uncomfortable conditions, but I really believe that they are designed by a loving creator to intentionally make me uncomfortable, to coerce me into changing my course of action. get some food, get some water, get some rest, get some shelter, and stop being a selfish jerk and start seeing what you can give to the world rather than what you can take from it. And so fear's got good purpose. You know, the idea is not to eradicate it, it's to minimize it and embrace it as a gift to get me to go back to the get between these guardrails to start sowing seeds of love again. And so when those things crop up, I don't have to sit there and analyze them. I just know that I'm disturbed, and so it's fear. So really what the way I read that is when I'm disturbed, right? And then it gives me four things to do on page 84. It tells me to ask God to remove it, talk to somebody, make an amend quickly if I've harmed anybody, and redirect my thoughts towards somebody that I can help. Let me break that down a little bit though, you know. So I'm in a situation where I'm feared up and you know, so my awareness of God is lacking or not there at all. And so I, you know, you hear it in another part of the big book where it talks about pause when agitated. It's the same thing here. I just stop, like, okay, God, please take this away. And then if I need to talk to somebody in order to figure out what my part is so that I can go clean up any wreckage or make an amend, then I will do that. But I'm careful when I tell people that, because a lot of people will use that as an excuse to just call you and burn your time up because they don't want to go out and help anybody. So they're sitting around bored and they want to invite me into their boredom. So I tell them right off the bat, if you bump into somebody in the hallway, it's okay to say, excuse me. You don't have to call me and ask permission. You know, if it's pretty obvious what you need to do, then, you know, clean it up. But if you're not certain, by all means, call me and then I'll help you. Because there's one thing that's available to everybody on this planet, but will never be available to me. And that's a clear, objective perspective of my life. You know, my perspective of my life is always clouded by my plans, designs, and desires. Your perspective of my life is not. And my perspective of your life is not clouded by your plans, designs, and desires. And so it's just another way I think our Creator designed us to make sure that we don't get off on our own. Because if you haven't noticed, we don't isolate well. You know, we put people in solitary confinement to break them, and we put our kids in timeout. We're not designed to be isolated and alone. And so this is just another way I think our Creator designed us to make sure that we don't get off on our own. So if I need to call you up, I'll call you up. I'm like, oh my God, I'm going crazy. Barf, 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 puke, 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 garbage, garbage, garbage. You know, being a little crybaby bee, right? And then I get it all out and you're like, okay, you're done being a little bee? Yeah, I'm done being a little bee. He's like, okay, so this is the chicken shit. This is the chicken salad. In other words, this is their stuff. You can't do anything about this is your stuff. I'm like, okay, cool. So then I do the third thing, which is make an amend quickly if you've harmed anybody. But truthfully, even if sometimes it's my behaviors that are blocking me off and nobody's necessarily getting harmed. So I'm either going to make the amend or I'm going to change the behavior. But once I've done everything I can in this moment, in this paradigm, I can't stop my thinking. So I redirect my thoughts. I can redirect my thoughts. And so I redirect my thoughts towards somebody that I can help, which obviously the best way to do that is to actually go and help somebody. But a lot of times I'm in a position where I'm not able to do that. And so I can just redirect my thoughts in that direction. So if it's just this little nugget of gold is, you know, just whenever I get disturbed, just stop and go, God, please take this away. Talk to somebody if necessary. Take the next action, which is, you know, clean up my part and make the amend and then redirect my thoughts. And I just keep doing that. And then they get these beautiful 10-step promises. If I keep doing that consistently, it says by this time, sanity will return. And it talks about love and tolerance of others is our code. Says the drink problem will be removed. Now, I already told you the way I read that is the effed up thinking that precedes the drink is going to get removed. In other words, you know, chaos starts coming around me. I'm going to recoil like a hot flame. I'm like, yeah, see you later. Want no part of it. And it seems to happen automatically without any effort on our part at all. That's the miracle of it. It says we're not cocky, nor are we afraid. We've just been placed in this position of neutrality, safe and protected. Haven't even sworn off. I just don't want to be part of it. And, says this is how we react as long as we stay in fit spiritual condition. And we have a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of our spiritual condition. I don't do days. I do paradigms. I get a paradigm reprieve. As long as I'm sowing seeds of love here, doing God's will in all my activities, God and love are synonymous to me. And so, you know, I'm just practicing sowing seeds of love. And then I got to do it again. Like when I get off this call and I go do what's next, I got to sow seeds of love there too. If I go take a drive, I got to sow seeds of love on the road, you know? And if I want to be happy and free, if I want to be content, if I don't want to be happy and content, then you can just discard everything I've been telling you. This is the line that got me when I first got exposed to this little nugget of gold, these little four things in the 10th step that can bounce me back. It said, this is the proper use of the will. Now, the reason why that got to me is because, you know, I've known for a long time that this isn't about the drink. And so, you know, when I look at the first step, you know, I look at that I have this yearning to be okay, this powerlessness condition, and I have all these human powers that I really enjoy, and there's nothing wrong because I yearn to be okay, and there's nothing wrong with me because I enjoy a lot of these human powers. But when I try to use those human powers to satisfy this yearning, I'm just using tools improperly. It's like being hungry, there's nothing wrong with me there. Having a nice car, there's nothing wrong with that. But if I go try to eat my car, we got a problem, right? I'm using tools improperly. And so, you know, I had to find, so I had to stop using those tools for that purpose, but I can't keep walking around empty. So I got to get tapped in this power. And this, you know, after I clean up the wreckage of my past, the 10th step shows me how to get tapped into that power. You know, through sowing seeds of love. And so now I know what the proper use of the will is. And the other thing is, you know, my self-centeredness is not a problem. It's normal. I'm stuck in my body. I can't get out. Everything I see is from a self-centered point of view. The problem is fear. The problem is when, you know, fear, I use my self-will, fear-driven, that's when it becomes a problem. And so I need to learn how to sow seeds of love. In other words, carry the vision of God's will into all my activities. That's the proper use of the will. Now, real quick before I move into the 11th step, a couple things that I like to say about my personal experience with the 10th. You know, I got introduced to that in 1996 when I was 7 years sober. And I started practicing it. And within a very short amount of time, it became so second nature that I do it before I even realize I'm doing it, you know, because it's the easier, softer way. There are people that have known me, you know, for 24 years now, right? That have never witnessed me disturbed. Now, I've been disturbed in the last 24 years. I'm just saying that it happens so infrequently. And when it does, it goes away so quickly because I drop those four things real quick. And so, you know, so I still get the benefit of being fear driven, but I don't have to stay in it. I can just kind of pass through. I don't need to move in. Right. And then, the other thing is, hold on 1 second, please. All right. You need to leave me alone.
I need cigarettes.
Okay.
I have two packs.
Okay. Go away.
All right.
You guys want to say hi to John real quick? Say hi, John.
Who is it?
It's a big group of people. Dwight's
hello,
in there.
Hello, AA people. How you doing?
So that's John. All right. Now go away and leave me alone.
Yeah.
All right. So the other thing too about this the last story I want to tell about the 10th step and about those four things and how powerful it is. I don't think I've had a bad dream in 24 years because as soon as I start having a bad dream, I automatically do those four things in my dream without even realizing I'm doing it. You know, it's just, like I said, it just happens seemingly without any effort on my part. It's the, you know, and then my dream turns into a good dream. It blows my mind, but it makes perfect sense because, you know, they say it centers in the mind, right? But I just don't have bad dreams. And, you know, if I start, it's for whatever reason, I just do those things in my dream and it works. So that's kind of the reactive way. You know, I wait till I get feared up. And when it happens, I've got those four things to do. But obviously the easier way would be if I didn't wait till I got feared up. In other words, was proactive about it. And the way to be proactive about it is to stay in this state of prayer and meditation, you know, on a regular basis. You know, just like I said, I don't like doing, I don't like thinking about the day. You know, I don't think God cares about our calendar, right? The Chinese don't even like our calendar. You know, it's a figment of man's imagination, but moment by moment. And so in the big book, when it says, you know, upon awakening, we do this and throughout the day we do that. And then before retiring at night, we constructively review our day. I can't think of a more constructive way to review my day, but to say thank you for everything that just, you know, just happened, including the things that didn't go my way. And if you think about the manners that you and I are conditioned with, you know, in our Christian-based society of please and thank you, it really fits with this too, with, like, you know, this paradigm analogy rather than a 24-hour day. So, you know, I go into a situation and I look around, I'm like, and I ask for guidance and for direction. I, you know, I'm, You know, what do you want me to do? You want me to hammer some nails and throw a mop around, do some dishes? What is it that you want me to do? You want me to get out? You want me to sit still? You want me to say something? You want me to shut up? What's the appropriate thing to do? I ask for guidance and for direction. I appreciate you letting me be here. What is it that you want me to do? And then I go do it. And then before I leave this paradigm, I constructively review what just happened here. You know, I say thank you for everything I can think of to say thank you for. And then I move on and go into the next paradigm and I do it again. I really believe that God is this power of love. And I don't think he's a man that's thinking about whether or not he's going to answer my prayers or not. I just don't, you know, I don't mean to offend anybody if you have that belief, but, what I really believe happens is when I pray or meditate, and praying is just how I express myself. Meditating is what I'm taking in. You know, I am a big fan of traditional prayer because it's very familiar to me and it's a very safe and intimate experience to do with other people. And I like it when I do get overwhelmed, like, God, get me out of this. Right. But it's a very small part of my total prayer. You know, my total prayer is the way I live my life, the choices that I make with my free will. You know, the Franciscan monks used to like to say, our prayer is in our work. Now, I don't like the word work because hard work is trying to live happy and free, not doing this. I really believe it's the easier, softer way, and calling it work is not attractive to the new guy. Add to the fact that it's just not it's a butchering of the English language. You know, it's not work. It's the easiest. It's beautiful. But prayer. So the majority of my prayer is, you know, how I execute my free will. How do I express myself to the world? And meditation, what I'm taking in, you know, what I'm observing, what I'm absorbing with all my senses. Not a big fan of traditional meditation. I've just never been able to get into it. If you are, more power to you, run with it. But, the thought of it bores me, but I sit around and I do a lot of, you know, Mother Teresa said it best. You know, she said, paraphrased, she basically said, look for God in all of his disguises. You know, because it's nothing. If God's everything, that means there's nothing that's not God. And so, even the things that we find disgusting, you know, if we look, we don't have to look too hard. But if we do it with intention, we can see God in everything. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to get that conscious awareness, right? So when I pray and I meditate, what ends up happening is I get that same thing that I get in the 10th step when I, you know, pause when agitated and ask God to remove it. I initiate this perception change from Steve-centered and what's the world doing for me and how am I going to get what I want and who's talking about me and what do they think of me and blah, 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 blah. And I go to this new perception of, oh, that's right. I keep forgetting this is God's world. It's not Steve's. I need to be seeing what I can do for God, not what he can do for me. You know, he's already given me everything I need. He's given me plenty of everything I need. I'm just very oblivious to it very often. I forget how grateful I really should be. But, I don't tell God what I want and ask me to go get it, ask him to help me get it. I ask God what he wants me to do and ask him to show me how to go about doing it. And it's always about either helping others or putting myself in a position to be able to more effectively help others. That's my experience. That's how, you know, we sow seeds of love. Like I said, I don't know what God is, but I do know the expression of God, which is love. And so I sow seeds of love, and that's how I get this awareness in my heart. And so, I pray and I meditate on a regular basis. And I think what happens, like I said, is when I pray and meditate, my perception changes. And then because I now have this new perception of God-centeredness, the choices I make with my free will changes. And because the world runs on action and reaction, cause and effect, the world's reactions to me changes. And it really looks like God just answered my prayers. But I honestly believe that it's a little bit more mathematical than that. I don't think it's mystical. I don't think it's, you know, voodoo. I don't think it's magic. I think this stuff is real because it's been working for me for a very long time. And the other thing I can't deny is, you know, whether I'm right or whether I'm delusional, one thing I know for sure is that prayer and meditation is part of every single religion that has ever been, you know, in mankind. And so it just works. So my suggestion is to pray soon and pray often. and what ends up happening is I proactively have this awareness of God, this conscious contact. I love Bill Wilson's choice of the words where he said conscious contact, because you know, it implies that we always have a contact. I'm just not always conscious of it. And so I do these little, you know, little tiny exercises that are very simple, but they have to be done. But I do these things in order to get that conscious awareness, or in other words, segueing into the 12th step, that spiritual awakening. I go from being asleep to being awoken, subconscious to being conscious, or unconscious to being conscious, and, you know, unaware to being aware. Call it whatever you want. Don't get caught up in the words, but get caught up in the action. You know, we have a chapter in the big book called Into Action, but there's no chapter called Into Studying or Into Thinking or Into, you know, figuring this thing out, you know. And it's the same thing with the Bible. There's a book called Acts, but there's no book called Figures It Out. You know, we just take the actions, we get the results, much like we did with the drugs and the alcohol. We took the action, got the results, and then we spent some time trying to figure it out, you know, when our lives didn't depend on it. And so so I don't do too much figuring it out. I just, you know, I learn and grow from my experiences. I examine my experiences to see what worked and what didn't work so that I can either repeat it if I like to or not repeat it if I don't. But either way, this stuff really works. And so I try to live in 11, you know, chronically. And obviously that's not only is that not possible, it's not healthy, because I would take it for granted if I never, you know, stepped out of that conscious awareness. But more importantly, if I never did, I wouldn't be able to help anybody. I wouldn't be able to serve God, because I wouldn't be able to identify with you, for one. But more important, I wouldn't have any compassion for you. I wouldn't have any love for you, because, you know, I wouldn't get it, you know. And so I have to know what it feels like to be feared up every now and then so that I can be more effective in helping you. Because if I don't know that feeling and I don't have that compassion when I'm trying to help you, I'm just going to be Charlie Brown's teacher, just wah, 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 wah. You know, another one of those people that I'm paying $200 an hour to tell me, you know, what's wrong with you? You got so much potential. You just pull it together. And in the Bible, they call it, in Corinthians, they say, you can have all the love or you can have all the wisdom or knowledge or whatever, but if you don't have love in your heart, you're just tingling cymbals. They actually say if you don't have charity, because love without service is not love, and service without love is not service. So they call it charity. But if you don't have charity in your heart, you're just tingling cymbals. You're just a bunch of noise. And so that's the best I have for you. And I feel like if I go on, I'm going to be a bunch of tingling cymbals with just a bunch of noise. So I'm going to shut up now. And I want to thank you guys very much for letting me try to serve. Have a good night.